All right. Well, we'll start this afternoon with a sense of aspiration and dedication, dedicating this session to all suffering beings, that we may become part of the solution instead of part of the problem. I think of myself all the time. Somebody said, you know, like Kempo Karthar Rinpoche said, that when you start your cultivation of a Buddhist practice, you should make a list of all of your greatest faults. And he said it's useful for several different reasons. One of them is so that you'll know what you're working on. And the other is so that you won't be so surprised when other people point them out. They'll let you know. We had that conversation earlier, didn't we? You know, it's like other people will kind of let us know if we're veering off the roadway. Okay, well, this time I will remember to recite the prayer once. We'll start with the refuge prayer. And you can join in your heart and in your mind if it's a prayer with which you are not familiar. Oh, Sanje Chudang So Chi Cho Nam La Jang Chu Pardu Don Ni Kyap Su Chi Da Ji Jin So Ji Be Su Nam Ki Drola Penshir Sanche Drupasho. O Palin Sawe Lama Rinpoche Dagi Ji Or Pede Ten Shila Kadrin Jembo Gwane Je Son Te Kusum Tugging A Drup Sao Du So. Okay, thank you. Oh, goodness. It's so pretty outside. So nice. Yeah, we're really lucky on days like today. I feel as though, you know, there's something lovely. There's something lovely in the air. As promised, I'm going to start this afternoon with saying a few words about meditation and how meditation figures into the path to freedom. As I mentioned earlier, all of our thoughts, feelings, and emotions can sometimes interfere with our ability to make changes in our life and to make positive changes in our life and personality and all of that. As a person who's been fighting that good fight for about 40 years, I can tell you that it does get easier, but there's still always something to learn. And so at any rate, but meditation helps us in that it opens our eyes to our patterns. Because usually we have to wait for somebody else to point our patterns out to us. But that's been my personal experience. People point my patterns out to me all the time. But it's also nice if we can catch our patterns and say, oh, there's one, and begin to work with it. And this is part of that practice that Rinpoche talked about, which is embracing what is genuine and letting go of that which is not worthwhile. And so when we practice meditation, we become more aware of individual thoughts. We join our ideas and our thoughts in the midst of an idea rather than in the midst of a story. Now, let me tell you the difference between that. When you're sitting and meditating, you might have a momentary thought like, oh, it's a beautiful day outside. And that doesn't do too much. And you can notice that and then return your attention to the breath. But if you've gone on, if you've moved on from it's a beautiful day to, oh, I'd love to be outdoors, and oh, what I did last week, and you know, I don't get out enough, and I really need to get out more, it's come from a single thought into a story. We've started to embroider a story of some kind. And embroidering that story, we then inhabit the world of that thought that has been given birth to, that thought has given birth to. And that's how we end up here in in one of the realms of existence, is by buying into these various stories that occur. And what meditation allows us to do is to notice when that thought is becoming a story. And it gives us the opportunity to do something different, to do something other than what we usually do. Because when a story starts up, if it's a story we like, well, we could keep going on it indefinitely. If anybody saw the Disney movie or Inside Out, what I liked about that movie was that it personified some of these emotions as little people in the head of this little girl. But you could also, there were also moments when you saw the little thoughts in the heads of the parents. And I got a big kick out of the mother feeling, she was angry and upset about something. And then she started thinking about a handsome hunk on the beach, you know, daydreaming about some Prince Charming who would come and sweep her away into a beautiful world of the beach. We do these kinds of things in order to not be present, in order to not be where we are. And I've done this so much that I've become quite familiar. Doesn't mean I don't go to the beach from time to time, but the idea is that once you notice that you're making that trip into a fantasy world, you can actually let go and return to the present moment. And you can do this with your breath by placing your attention on the breath and coming back to the breath. Even when you're not meditating, when you're in the midst of perhaps a very difficult conversation and you're starting to spin a story such as this person doesn't like me, or another story why does this person say this to me? Or why am I feeling so negative toward that person? You know, these little stories that we come up with. We can interrupt those stories by just removing our attention from them and placing our attention on the breath or something else. And the other types of things we can place our attention on at that moment, besides the breath, because when we put our attention back on the breath when we're in that moment of conflict or whatever, we have then let go of that which is not worthwhile, which is going down the rabbit hole of that negative emotion. But it's not the only thing that we can choose. We could choose mantra practice. I have a friend who really loves the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. And they were saying, you know, sometimes I feel angry about things. And in order to stop feeling angry, I start thinking the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Is that all right? Is that a good use of the mantra? And the answer is absolutely, absolutely. It's like the perfect use of the mantra. Because as we noted in answer to your question the other day, each of the syllables of that mantra is the purification of one of the six negative mental afflictions that lead to these negative experiences in samsara. And so Om Mani Padme Hum is perfect because it's, I guess you could call it good medicine for our mental afflictions. Another thing we can place our attention on in these moments when we're discarding or those things that are not worthwhile and embracing what's genuine, we can also take hold of a practice such as Tonglen, which is compassion meditation. Thinking in that moment, I take on the negative mental afflictions of all beings in this mental affliction that I am feeling right now. And may I and all beings be free of these mental afflictions. So in that way, we can let go of that which is not worthwhile and embrace that which is genuine. Some people have said that to use mantra practice and to imagine that one is a bodhisattva, such as Chenrezig, One person once asked Kimperbuche, isn't that sort of fake? Aren't you sort of faking it? Because you don't know that you're Chenrezig or Tara or any of those Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. And Rinpoche's answer was quite simple. He said, look, you've made up who you think you are right now. You've made it up completely. So why couldn't you be Chenrezig? Why couldn't you be a Manjushri? Why couldn't you be Tara? So from that point of view, he said, and then he went on to say, and in a way, it's more honest. It's more honest to visualize yourself as a bodhisattva because it's closer to your Buddha nature. It's closer to what you really are. And so that was his answer to the person who said, visualizing yourself as a Buddha or a bodhisattva, that's so dishonest, because honesty was the value that they valued more than Dharma. I mean, you know, that's how it is sometimes. Which reminds me, interesting story from my work as a newspaper reporter. You really do learn a lot about what people value because you interview people all the time. One of my favorite quotes was from one of my coworkers. Her value was honesty. She thought honesty was like the most important thing. And so she, one day we were looking over the newspaper and she said, you know who's a real fake? A real dishonest person. That Mother Teresa. What a fake. What a fake. She says, everybody I see in the street, that's Jesus. She says, how ridiculous. She obviously is making that up, and she's obviously being dishonest. How dishonest of her. And so what was really interesting was that there was something about Mother Teresa's, the depth of the compassion that Mother Teresa was showing to the street people of India that really troubled her. There was something about that that she had to diminish. She had to diminish it by saying that it was dishonest. And, you know, I do this, and we all do this. But I find it so interesting, the things that we do in life that prevent us from practicing or looking at the Dharma in a genuine way. Anyway, just a couple of thoughts that are floating through my head on the topic of how to let go of that which is not worthwhile and how to embrace that which is genuine. Anyway, so this is why it is more honest. It is more honest to visualize oneself as a Buddha or Bodhisattva than it is to not do that, because it's closer to what we really are. And for Mother Teresa, it was closer to what she really was, to imagine that she was the hands of Jesus and that she was working with Jesus. So the idea is God is everywhere and God is everything. That was her method of practice. And it may not have met my coworker's idea of honesty, but it did meet Mother Teresa's nexus of practice, her method, her matrix of practice. It met that. So it's fascinating. But shamatha gives us the opportunity to do all of this, because letting go of a single thought in shamatha permits us to interrupt anything. If you can let go of one thought in shamatha, you can interrupt anything. You can interrupt an argument you're having. You can interrupt. I did this with my husband once. We were, you know, as spouses do, I'm right. No, I'm right. No, I'm right. And so forth and so on. And then suddenly I said, you know, this is crazy. Why are we doing this? This is dumb. Of course you're right. And he's like, really? You mean you're just going to let it go just like that? And I'm like, mm-hmm. Because it's more important to have peace than it is for me to be right 100% of the time, which of course is my preference, but still. But shamatha gave me the ability to do that. And another one of my famous stories is I had a resentment going against a friend, And I was really resentful about this guy. It's like, why did he act this way and why did he do this? I'm doing something repetitive, right? You know, I'm washing stuff. And while I've got the soap in my hands and everything, I suddenly think, what am I doing? Why am I being so angry at this guy? He's not even here. And he's not even doing the thing I'm accusing him of doing right now. I mean, what? What am I doing to myself? I'm just going to let this go right now. And I did. I still had soapy hands, but the problem was resolved. So this is what shamatha allows us to do, to make different and hopefully better choices about what we do with our energy and our time. So the reason I bring this up is because the path to liberation that the Buddha is pointing out, do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind, is facilitated by taming your mind. It's doing no harm helps us to restrain ourselves. And doing virtue helps us to move forward when we are a little bit scared to move forward sometimes. Do I really want to go do that good thing? Or will that be embarrassing? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is how change is made. Little by little by little by little. So I wanted to at least start this afternoon by saying a couple of words about the benefits of shamatha, mantra practice, and compassion practice as methods to help to let go what's not worthwhile and embrace what's genuine. Any questions about this part? Okay, just had to check. We have handouts. Yay, handouts. Anybody like to help me with the handouts? Okay, one for this side, one for this side. Thanks also to Justin.
He's not here.
Who's not here? Okay. Yeah. Oh, mom things. Yay, mom. Yeah. Okay, let me grab my book here. Oh, by the way, thanks to Kathy Lamo for bringing the trainings in compassion. This was the book that I was trying. Thank you. I was trying to remember the title of today. The one I couldn't remember the title of. The one that's out of print. Trainings in compassion. Thank you, dear. Trainings in compassion. And what it is that in the back, there's a the commentary by the 15th Karmapa. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, no problem. The commentary by the 15th Karmapa on the Chenrezig practice. And in the little corners, in the margins, there are these pictures, these little vignette pictures of the Buddhas in the different realms. And I'll just, I'm just going to, we got time, right? Okay, we got a couple minutes. This will probably take about 5 minutes maximum to read. It's Karmapa's, the 15th Karmapa's explanation of Om Mani Padme Hum. It's also for your son. This secret mantra, the six syllables, Om Mani Padme Hum, is the embodiment of the energy and power of all the compassion and an activity of noble Avalokiteshvara, who is himself the embodiment of the wisdom energy of all Buddhas. The white Om, born from the self-display of the five wisdoms of the noble ones, is the syllable of combined qualities and is of the nature of the perfection of meditation. So there's a chart that's been created on this, so you don't have to write it all down. It purifies the mental affliction of pride, along with the results thereby produced, in particular, the sufferings of the gods, which is death and falling. Inseparable from the body and activity of Shatakratu, the Buddha among the gods. It is the self-radiance of the wisdom of equanimity arisen in visible form. It guides the six classes of beings to the southern pure realm, the glorious, and enables them to obtain the body of the Buddha, Ratnasambhava. So Shatakratu is the Buddha among the gods, and he's playing a lute. So he magnetizes the gods through music. The green syllable ma, born from the display of compassionate noble one's limitless loving kindness toward all beings, is the syllable of activity and is of the nature of the perfection of patience. It purifies the mental affliction of jealousy along with all the results thereby produced, in particular the suffering of the jealous gods, fighting and struggle. Inseparable from the body and activity of Vimachitra, the Buddha among the jealous gods, it is the self-radiance of the all-accomplishing wisdom arisen in visible form. It guides the six classes of beings to the northern pure realm, called the perfect action, and enables them to attain the body of the Buddha Amoghasiddhi. And he appears to be carrying a victory banner and a sword, a flaming sword of wisdom. The yellow syllable ni, born from the display of the great all-pervading and effortless compassion of the noble ones, is the syllable that reverses samsara into the expanse of nirvana on the spot. The vajra wisdom of combined body, speech, mind, and activity, it is of the nature of the perfection of ethics. It purifies the stains of ignorant dualistic fixation along with all the results thereby produced, in particular the four great rivers of human suffering: birth, aging, sickness, and death. Inseparable from the body and activity of Shakyamuni, the Buddha among humans, it is the self-radiance of self-existing wisdom arisen in visible form. It guides the six classes of beings to the pure realm of Akanishta, the completely pure Dhamma Dhatu, and enables them to obtain the body of the Buddha Vajradhara. And then Shakyamuni is depicted as a monastic carrying a begging bowl and the staff with ringing, the ringing staff that the alms takers would carry to announce their alms rounds. So he's wearing his monastic robes and carrying his monastic staff and holding his begging bowl. The sky blue syllable pe, or pad, born from the self-display of limitless equanimity, the compassion of the noble ones that does not lapse into partiality, is the syllable of the body and is of the nature of perfection of supreme knowledge. It purifies the mental affliction of ignorance, along with the results thereby produced, in particular the suffering of animals, bewilderment, dullness, and servitude. Inseparable from the body and activity of, let me see if I can pronounce this, Dhruva Simha, the Buddha among animals, it is the self-radiance of the Dharma Dhatu wisdom arisen in visible form. It guides the six classes of beings to the central pure realm, the densely arrayed, and enables them to attain the body of the Buddha Varachana. And it appears that he's holding a book. The Buddha is holding a book. The red syllable may, born from the self-display of limitless joy, the compassion of the noble ones that is equal for all, is the syllable of speech and is of the nature of the perfection of generosity. It purifies attachment and miserliness along with all the results thereby produced, in particular the suffering of the hungry ghosts, hunger, and thirst. Inseparable from the body and activity of Javalamukha, the Buddha among the hungry ghosts, it is the self-radiance of self of discriminating awareness and wisdom arisen in visible form. It guides the six classes of beings to the Western pure realm, Sukhavati, and enables them to attain the body of the Buddha Amitabha. I can't quite tell what he's holding, but it appears to me to be like a bowl that probably contains milk, because it does appear to have a white, some kind of white liquid in it. It's a large bowl with white liquid, so I'm guessing it's the milk that satisfies the hungry ghosts. The black syllable hum, born from the self-display of limitless compassion, the compassion with which the noble ones look upon all beings as they would their own children, is the syllable of mind and is of the nature of the perfection of supreme knowledge. It purifies dualistic anger, along with all the results thereby produced, in particular the suffering of hell beings, extreme heat and cold. Inseparable from the body and activity of Dharmaraja, the Buddha among the hell beings, it is the self-radiance of mirror-like wisdom or is an invisible form. It guides the six classes of beings to the pure realm of true joy and enables them to obtain the body of the Buddha Akshobhya. The embodiment of all the energy of the limitless activity of shaking the six classes of beings from the depths of samsara is this very syllable, six syllable king of mantras. And so the Buddha, who is among the hell beings, has a conch shell containing cooling liquid, I'm assuming, and then fire in his other hand. So that's just a little review. Thank you very much for bringing that. Oh, sure. Yeah, she also has a book here with an illustration of the six realms. Thank you. With the little Buddhas inside the realm, so you can just see them. Just imagine Buddha here. You know, like imagine Buddha here, and imagine Buddha here, and imagine Buddha here, and imagine Buddha here. Who wrote The Trainings in Compassion? I think it's under the name of the translator, Tyler DeWar. The book's out of print right now, so I'm hoping that somebody, I mean, I hate to have to pay like 80, 90, 100 bucks for it, but sometimes that happens with books on the internet. Okay, so now, I wanted to move outward to the outer ring of the wheel of life. This outer ring depicts what are called the 12 links of interdependence, and those 12 links are listed on this handout. You need a handout there, Bill? Why not? You never know. It could be useful. I'm going to read to you from Trungpa Rinpoche's book on 12 links, because I feel that his descriptions are quite good. He says, basically what he's saying is that it all begins with the first link, which you'll see here on this circular drawing from Kalu Rinpoche's book, Luminous Mind, is at about 1 o'clock, if it were a clock face. And it says ignorance. And it's basically a person who is walking with a cane and is bent over. And it's supposed to signify a person with limited vision, setting out on a journey. So the idea here is that the symbolism is not knowing where we are going, we nonetheless go. The second of the images is called mental formations, and it's the picture is of a person making a clay pot. This has to do with how ignorance leads us to mental formation of habits and emotions that then leads to the development of consciousness, which is the third of the illustrations, which is a monkey in a house. The monkey is in the house with six entrances or six windows or six openings, symbolizing the five senses and the sixth consciousness, which is thought. The fourth is name and form, two people in a boat, which has to do with who we are when we are still, I guess you could say when we're still in the womb. It really stands for the five aspects or the five component parts of self, name, form, mental formation, perception and consciousness. All of those, they call them the five skandhas. And so name and form are shorthand for the five skandhas. I jokingly call the two guys in the boat Mr. Name and Mr. Form. But, you know, that just helps me remember that's not who they really are. I'm going to get in trouble someday because some lama is going to say, you know, what your students told me that you taught them was like, what were you thinking? And I'm like, yeah, okay. The fifth one is the sixth sense media, meaning the five senses, and the sixth, which is the mental consciousness. The sixth is contact, and that's where we make contact with a sense object. The seventh is sensation, where we form an opinion about what we experience. The eighth is craving, which means that we form a wish either to take or to get away from something. The ninth is grasping, where we actually adopt. Sometimes it's called adoption, where we actually take or adopt an action, which then results in becoming, birth, old age, and death. And so these 12 links talk about how we create our experience moment to moment or life to life. You can look at it life to life or moment to moment, either one. Trungpa Rinpoche says this, and it's also in Kala Rinpoche's book, that these 12 links describe the four bardos, or four in-between states. The word bardo means in-between or interval. The bardo of death being at 12 o'clock on this drawing. So the previous life has just ended, and now we are resting in the bardo of emptiness, which is above the drawing for ignorance. And the reason it is above that drawing is that after we die, we experience our Buddha nature briefly in an experience called the experience of clear light. So when we experience our Buddha nature, if we recognize the clear light as being our mind's nature, then we are liberated in that moment and take a purified rebirth in a pure realm. If we don't recognize our mind's nature in that moment of clear light, then we enter something called the bardo of becoming. And as you can see, the bardo of becoming here is steps 2 through 10. In that, while we're in the bardo, we experience this moment of emptiness that then leads us to reconfigure ourselves around an idea of self. And then gradually, as a child in the womb, we form the five skandhas, the six sense openings, and then contact, sensation, craving, grasping, and becoming. And then we are born into yet another life, birth, and then old age and death. And so you could say that all four bardos are represented here. The bardo of death of the previous life, the bardo of emptiness, the bardo of becoming toward the next life, and then that next life, the bardo from birth to death. Okay, questions about this part? Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And I'm wondering how they might
We're going to need Lamatashi for that. She's saying that, I have to repeat for the recording, that Lamatashi, when he was here previously, gave us teachings about the various choices we can make in the bardo and how we can choose rebirth in a pure realm when the when our Buddha nature appears to us first in the form of clear light, and then in the form of various Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They call it the 100 peaceful and wrathful deities of the bardo. And the questioner was asking whether or not, where the correlation is when the different aspects of the bardo of becoming, which of these, looks like 8 different experiences, where this happens. And I don't know. I'm not sure. I know that we have to have some concept of self in the bardo, because I remember him saying that we have a mental body in the bardo. But whether the mental body arises in the bardo before we have experienced the 100 peaceful and wrathful deities or after, I'm not sure. If that's the case, then the appearance of the 100 peaceful and wrathful deities, if that's the case, then the appearance of the 100 peaceful and wrathful deities would be that black line between the bardo of emptiness and the bardo of becoming. If that's the case, that they appear before the arising of a mental body in the bardo. That would be my completely random, somewhat informed guess. But if that's not the case, if we arise as a mental body and then we experience the peaceful and wrathful deities of the bardo, then I got no clue whatsoever. So it's got, I got half a clue and I got no clue. But this is really interesting, and we should ask Lamatashi to come back and teach us some more. Because I think he just gave marvelous teachings on the bardo, and they really helped me a lot. So, yes. Trungpa Rinpoche talks about this in this very first description of ignorance. He says, let's see if I can find it. Because he talks about this. It's quite a long one, okay. My favorite one is The Great Path of Awakening. That's my all-time favorite. That is my all-time favorite book. Yeah, this one I have read less long. Now, I'm sure he says it in here, but I'm missing it. But the idea here is that if ignorance is dissolved, then the rest of the 12 don't appear. So liberation happens there. At the step of the bardo, of ignorance. At the step of ignorance. Whether we're talking about, you can actually use the 12 links to describe something that happens to us in this life. He does this in the book. He says he uses the 12 links to describe a single action. It's not a very nice action. It's the action of killing a human being. And he says that the first step is ignorance, where you don't know that it's wrong to kill. And then you form the idea to kill, and then you look for the opportunity, you get the weapon, you kill the person, and then you feel the satisfaction, and then that gives rise to your next experience, which may be your own suffering at the hands of the family of the person you've killed, or at the hands of the law, and so forth and so on. But it all begins with ignorance. And once ignorance is undone, then the remainder of the 12 links do not arise. That's how he explains it. But does that answer the? Yes, it's. We could say it's ground to a halt. But yeah, you could say that. You could say that. And he says because of this first link of ignorance, one ends up in samsara. Where the whole samsaric process goes on. But basic ignorance is expressed in the sutras as not recognizing the dharmata, the nature of mind and phenomena. And so he said that basically when one recognizes the nature of one's own mind, then that dissolves the entire process of samsara from the first step. That's where it's unhooked. It gets unhooked there. Other questions? Yes. You know, I think that for each person it might be a little bit different, but the questioner is asking what's the best practice for recognizing the nature of mind. I think that there are a couple ways to go about it. One is to practice the shamatha and vipassana of the sutras, and another would be to practice the shamatha and vipassana of Mahamudra. And I think that that what he's saying in this book and the 12 Links book is he's saying Mahamudra is faster. He's saying that practicing in the sutra tradition takes several eons, but he says the Vajrayana. He says, although the Hinayana is a wonderful approach and benefits many beings, it is said in the scripture that the time it might take to go through the process of Hinayana and Mahayana could be as long as three countless eons, which is in the order of millions of years. Basically, what this means is that as we discard negativity and embrace positivity, it changes our karma and it changes how we experience things, and that would take us closer and closer to experiencing the nature of mind. Then he goes on to say, the Vajrayana gives us the opportunity to reach Buddhahood quickly. The Vajrayana recognizes that while it is important to analyze external phenomena, which is what you do in the sutra tradition, this process takes a long time. The Vajrayana approach is to examine the mind, which is very close and far easier to analyze. And then he gives the methodology. One of the methodologies is analyzing what mind is, looking for its color, looking for its shape, looking for its location, its beginning and end. And each time one fails to find that, resting in a sense of confidence that that's how mind is, and doing this over and over again under the guidance of a teacher, because if you try to do this without a teacher, it's going to be very difficult. And we might make a mistake about mind and then not know we've made a mistake. The other methods are the practice in the practice of Mahamudra. And in Mahamudra, how they have you practice is they have you practice, I guess what you could say is you can practice through the preliminaries, which are called nundro. And in that practice, every day you practice Mahamudra by sitting on your meditation seat and visualizing that you're in the presence of enlightened beings. You pray and make offerings to them, and then you dissolve them into you. And then you think that your mind and the mind of the guru have mixed inseparably, and then you rest your mind in that. And that is an opportunity to recognize nature of mind, and you'll have it every day, every day, every day, every day, every day, every day, for years until you've had the opportunity to practice it a lot. And as you have an opportunity to practice it a lot, you might really begin to get a sense of comfort with your own mind. And you might also get a sense of comfort with looking at your mind. This kind of Mahamudra can also be practiced by doing what's called deity yoga. For some people, they'll know it as the practice of Tara or Chenrezig or Manjushri or whatever. But at the conclusion of that, you also dissolve the deity who is said to be inseparable from your guru. You dissolve that into yourself and rest yourself in the confidence that your mind and the guru's mind have mixed inseparably. So by doing this kind of practice over and over again, you get a stronger sense of how your mind is. And then after you've had a chance to practice the preliminaries for a while, then some people accumulate up to 111,111 of these various preliminaries, such as refuge prayers and Vajrasattva mantras, offerings of the mandala, and the guru yoga prayers. And after they've done all of that, they go to their teacher and they ask for something called pointing out instruction. And then the master points out the nature of their mind, and then they they have some sense of confidence about how to practice with that. And then they practice with that for some days, weeks, months, years, and then they have the opportunity to see the nature of their mind. I think that for those of us who are beginners, the easiest way to practice this sort of thing would be to practice an understanding of impermanence and to contemplate impermanence. Because when we're beginners, it's a little hard to try to grasp the idea of the nature of one's mind, but it's very easy to analyze one's own experience to see the impermanence in it. And then once you grasp impermanence, you can work with your teacher to start to meditate on mind, or do Nundro, or do the deity yoga, or something like that. But I'd say for a lot of people, the easiest route is to start by looking at the impermanence of everything. Yeah. Well, that's right. And I think that's why the Tibetans were so quick to teach us Chenrezig practice and Nundro, because we never know how long we have, you know. We'd like to think we're going to live a long time, but anything can happen. It's a crazy world. Mm-hmm. Time for one more? One more out there? Okay. Yeah.
I'm curious, with the deity practice, a lot of times we break into other realms. Are there other ways of helping you into other realms?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'd say from my point of view, the question was, how do we help beings in these six realms? To me, Chenrezig practice would probably be the easiest, because the mantra is said to stir samsara from its depths, meaning that it begins to sort of reverberate throughout the universe and benefit all the beings in all those places. Especially if you visualize that you're benefiting beings all over through doing the Chenrezig practice, that's really excellent. And every mantra practice you do begins to thin out our grasping. And so as it thins out our grasping, then we become less attached to the things of this world, and we have the potential to become a little bit more awakened in our behavior and things like that. But I'd say Chenrezig practice is probably the easiest. But also, you know this from your own experience, that Medicine Buddha, because of the power of his aspirations, that's also powerful, and it benefits beings in all realms. And there are visualizations included in the Medicine Buddha practice that benefit beings in other realms. And the same is true for the Amitabha practice. It benefits beings in other realms. Then the Nyungne retreat especially benefits beings in the hungry ghost realm, because there's a special visualization in which we benefit the hungry ghosts when we send them love, compassion, and comfort. And so the Nyungne practice is really good for beings in that realm. But there's even more you can do. For example, Kemp Karza Rinpoche, when he was giving that teaching on prostrations recently, this maybe a few months ago at KTD, he said that sometimes in Tibet, they'll put images of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas on rock faces and show them to the public, so that people, animals, birds, and so forth can see these. Or they'll toss rocks bearing the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum into streams to benefit animals there. Some people will take Dharma medicine and put them into lakes and streams to benefit the animals there. I know people who put mantras in front of their pet's dish, and pictures of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of their pet's dish so that their pet will see it. And I remember there was a question that came up during that about people with sort of rough behavior who might be in public life. And how can we benefit these people in public life who have rough behavior? And he said, well, just display images of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and mantras to them. And so I made the joke at that time that should there be any, you know, special rallies that are political in nature, at least one person should have Om Mani Padme Hung on a sign. Or a picture of the Buddha on a stick, you know. Why not?
I mean...
Mm-hmm. Beings in the hell realms, Chenrezi practice definitely, and Medicine Buddha practice definitely. You could even dedicate the merit of any of your practices to beings in the hell realms. I met a young man once who said, I want to die as soon as possible and be reborn in hell, please, so that I can benefit beings there. And Kemp Rinpoche had to try to talk him out of that. Because he felt such a kinship for the hell beings, he wanted to be reborn there instantly. And Rinpoche had to remind him that he had to get enlightened first before being reborn in the hell realm. Because he said, it's going to be a long time before you get out, and you might feel resentment. You might feel that your bodhisattva motivation is so pure right now that once you get there, you won't feel a bit of resentment for being in hell. But he said, you don't know. So it might be better if you got reborn in a pure realm first. Yes? That's an excellent question. We will have to ask one of the scholars that. I would make the assumption that the answer to that would be yes. I would have to make the assumption because it has to do with the delusion of a mind that is overcome with delusion. And if your mind is overcome with delusion, it could be overcome with delusion in any of the realms of existence. So my guess, even though the examples here appear to refer only to the human realm, there have got to be some, but we would have to ask one of the scholars for that. I would be very interested in knowing. Too bad Justin's not here. He was writing down questions for us. So, darn. Okay, we'll see if we can ask him. So I'll go ahead now and continue reading about this. Basic ignorance, which is the first step, this is according to Trungpa Rinpoche's book, is expressed in the sutras as not recognizing the nature of things. Basic ignorance is expressed as not recognizing, also expressed as not recognizing the essence of mind. Either way, it is the root ignorance, while accompanying ignorance goes along with our thoughts and feelings. When there is a very gross and coarse level of thinking, such as, for example, the desire for things that seem so powerfully attractive to the mind, instead of recognizing what is happening and recognizing the truth that such things are empty of inherent nature, one instead thinks that the things that one desires are very important and worth getting. One is both ignorant of the true nature of mind, basic ignorance, and deluded by the apparent nature of phenomena, which is called accompanying ignorance. So there's two kinds of ignorance, basic ignorance, not knowing the nature of your mind, and accompanying, or we might call it companion ignorance, which is being deluded by the apparent nature of things. He says, the same is true of anger. What seems unpleasant is rejected with aversion. Not recognizing the empty nature of appearances, there is accompanying ignorance as well. Sometimes there is neither the power of attraction nor rejection, but just a mental dullness. Again, not recognizing the true nature is accompanied by delusion. These are the three main mental poisons, desire, aversion, and mental dullness, all accompanied by ignorance. Because ignorance accompanies thoughts and feelings, one acts and does things, creating the next link in the chain of interdependent origination, which is karmic creation. He calls it karmic creation instead of mental formation. So does anybody else have questions about the first link of ignorance? Anybody? Okay. Karmic creation, the three root poisons of mind, desire, aggression, and stupidity are rooted in ignorance and cause us to act. The strength of these passions or disturbing emotions, called kleshas in Sanskrit, is sometimes very strong, overwhelming, and sometimes very weak, only having a slight influence on the mind. The power of these emotions determines our actions, which result in karma. For instance, sometimes we feel a very powerful sense of love and compassion toward others and develop virtuous karma. With these feelings, we perform actions that are loving and compassionate, the result being positive or virtuous action. Sometimes the disturbing emotions become very strong, and we then do unvirtuous actions, such as lying, stealing, or harming others. Whether we do virtuous or unvirtuous actions determines whether we will experience pleasure or pain in the future. Virtuous actions lead to more samsaric, unvirtuous actions lead to more samsaric suffering. Karma literally means action. There are three kinds of action, three kinds of karma, positive, negative, and neutral. Positive karma is the result of actions which lead to pleasant results. Negative karma are actions which lead to unpleasant results, and neutral karma is neither positive nor negative. Meditation, the practice of placing the mind and letting it rest one-pointedly, is an action that creates neutral karma. However, meditation can produce positive results, so that if one meditates thoroughly and long enough, one can actually produce the results of being reborn not in the human realm, but in the form realm of the gods, or even the formless realm. So there are three kinds of karma: virtuous, unvirtuous, and neutral. And so then he says, then he talks about the two aspects of karma, which we may or may not have time to discuss. He says, here's what he says. He says, due to ignorance, the mind has the disturbing emotions of desire, anger, or aggression, and so forth. Because of these, we perform unvirtuous actions. These actions have later consequences and create what is called bringing together of circumstances, or karmic creation. The resulting effect of our actions is the second link of interdependent origination. For example, if one has harmed another being by killing in the past, in the future, one's own life force will be damaged. One might be killed or become very sick. As a result of our actions, we experience something. And then the second aspect of karma is called the cause for developing a tendency, in which an action has a conditioning effect so that the action becomes easier to do the next time. For example, if you do one thing and then it has an effect, then it creates momentum that you might do that action again. And so he says that whatever action we do, whether it's positive or negative, we develop a habit and become used to it, making it easier to do in the future. These types of actions possess a cause that will produce the two types of result, future experience and conditioning. So that's the second link, karmic conditioning. Thoughts about this? Questions about this? The potter making pots. Okay. The third of the 12 links is called consciousness. The third link is consciousness, meaning that A, because of the first link of ignorance, B, we perform an action, which is the second link, and C, this action plants a seed in our mind, or we could say imprints and conditions our consciousness. At some time later, through the conditioning, through the seed that has been planted, a certain experience will occur in the future. A certain habitual tendency will be there in the future because of what we have done in the past. There is both a potential for experience and a potential for being and acting a certain way. These seeds or imprints are sown in our stream of consciousness. Our conditioned consciousness is thus the third link in the chain, conditioned, referring to karmic imprints. So does anybody have any questions about that? The idea is that our now conditioned consciousness is ready for the next phase of becoming. First we had ignorance, not knowing, and then from there we had the development of karmic tendencies. From there we develop our consciousness, which is conditioned in a certain way, ready for action, And then more happens after that. Any questions about this part? Okay. There's one more thing he says here. The actions of our body, speech, and mind make imprints. But the imprints themselves are all in the mind, in the stream of consciousness. Whether we are acting physically, verbally, or mentally, we are conditioning our mind. The mind never stops continuing like a stream, but the body and speech are interrupted and do not go on forever. The physical karma we engage in makes a certain set of imprints in our ongoing consciousness, and these imprints eventually become the body we have in our next life. Each verbal action we perform makes imprints and conditions our stream of consciousness. This eventually determines the quality of our speech in a future life. So we can see that this ongoing stream of consciousness, this which is continually being conditioned, is becoming a cause for the fourth link. Any questions? Okay. Name and form. Number four. The title name and form is another word for the five mental aggregates, or skandhas. Name refers to the last four: feelings, cognition, mental events, and consciousness. Form refers to the first aggregate. What does this mean? This means that after we have died and been reincarnated in a new life, we are conceived and at first do not yet have a complete body with all the feelings and mental activities, which very much depend upon the way our body is made up. Form is literally the embryo and the potential for the aggregates. All the genetic potential for the form that is to come is the conditioned potential for the various feelings, conditions, cognitions, and consciousness that will emerge once the body is formed. They are present, but only in name, and for this reason they are called name. We don't have eyes yet, and so one cannot have the eye consciousness, etc. At the time of the Buddha asked that temples display a drawing of the six realms of existence. In Tibet, this has been formalized in the Wheel of Life painting. These paintings all have rooster, snake, and pig in the center, representing the three root emotions of passion, aggression, and ignorance. Next is a circle with six divisions, representing the six realms of samsara. Finally, along the outside is a circle depicting the 12 links that lead to samsara. Okay. Any questions about name and form? Yes. Yes. I'm going to read a from his description, because I think that'll be easier. Form, feeling, cognition, mental events, and consciousness. Is that five?
Okay.
Name and form is shorthand for the five skandhas. The others only exist in name. And so the idea is that form is the first of the skandhas mentioned, but the rest of them are only there nominally, because there may be an embryo, there may be some cells, but it's not a person yet. So the other skandhas only exist in name only. Uh-huh. The potential. Other question? Onward. The five perceptual entrances. The fifth one. The six perceptual entrances. I'm sorry. It's number five. It's link number five, but it's the six sense entrances. Visual faculty, hearing faculty, smell faculty, tasting faculty, physical sensation, and mental faculty. When the organ of sight develops, it will eventually become the basis for the visual consciousness. As the ear develops, it will give us the basis for auditory consciousness, and so on. Let's see. Because the organs of the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body develop in the womb, because they will eventually allow our perceptions of the world to enter, they are called the doors of perception or perceptual entrances. Perception itself, however, does not occur at this fifth step and must wait for the sixth link, which is contact. Questions about this? Yeah. Uh-huh. Smell, hearing, and then tactile or the touch. And then the sixth one is the mental consciousness. Other? Okay, forging on. Contact. The word contact has a very precise meaning here. It means the contact of the faculty, that is the five sense faculties and the mind, the mental faculty, with an object through the link of consciousness. Three things are happening simultaneously. There's the object, the faculty, and the linking consciousness. For instance, there is an object to be seen, the visual faculty, and the visual consciousness. When those three are present simultaneously, then the visual consciousness is operating. Once the perceptual entrances develop, the eyes of the fetus in the womb can see visual things. So there's visual contact, the ears can hear things, the nose can smell things, the tongue can taste flavors, the body feels sensations, and so forth. The mind reacts to those things with various feelings and thoughts, so there is mental contact. Let's see. When the sense object, the sense organ, and the consciousness associated with it come together, we have the experience of the world, which gives rise to the seventh link, which is feeling. Any questions about contact? Okay. In the chain of the 12 links of interdependence, one link gives rise to the next. Each link is the cause for the next one to arise. Once there are perceptual entrances, there can be sense contact. And once there is contact, then a feeling will arise. The feeling can be pleasant, unpleasant, or indifferent or neutral. For instance, when the eye sees something that is beautiful, that creates a pleasant feeling. If it sees something ugly, there's an unpleasant feeling. Eyes can also see things which are not particularly ugly or beautiful, and then there is the neutral feeling of indifference. The raw feeling of a quality of good, bad, and indifferent is the seventh link. Feelings such as those of compassion can lead to positive karma. Feelings such as hatred can lead to negative karma. Any questions about this? Let's see what it says. I'm going to say that they would have to be, even though he doesn't say that, he doesn't say that explicitly here, that would have to be the case because for example, he was saying that there has to be an object, and then there has to be the faculty, and then there has to be the linking consciousness. So if the object were not there, you would still maybe be reacting to the mental image of that thing that's in the mental consciousness. So maybe it could, but it might fluctuate. You might be attending to one thing at one moment and another thing at another moment. But he doesn't say that explicitly here. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I think that what you've said is actually, it's the way I understand what he's been talking about. Because, I mean, you know, it's all imperfect, right? But, you know, but the way I understand what he's saying is that from the initial non-recognition of mind's nature at the clear, at the, you know, the bardo of emptiness, from that non-recognition then arises these building blocks. They're like little, it's like watching a chain form, isn't it? Because from ignorance then arises our experience of our karma, which our karmic formation, which then leads to a conditioned consciousness, which then leads to the skandhas. It's almost like an unfoldment, isn't it? It's like a sprouting of something, an unfoldment. And so from this conditioned consciousness then arises the skandhas of the embryo in the womb, which is the form with all of the rest of the things just nominally there, name and form, the skandhas. And then as the embryo turns into a child, then we have the perceptual entrances. Then we have contact with something, with an experience. Then we have the sensation, the feeling, of which is either pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And then that gives rise to craving, which is either craving to get away from something or craving to bring something to us. And then that leads us to taking action to grasp or get away. And then that brings us to the sort of becoming of where our next phase of being is unfolding. And so, yes, it seems to me that this is both, in my mind, it's both describing the process of the bardo of becoming, but it also could be the minute analysis of what is happening to us every instant in this life. Because we do not recognize mind, and because of our karmic formation, which then has kicked in because of non-recognition, the karma is still there. It's like a basis. It's like a foundation. It's like a mat upon which everything else is built. Then that gives rise to the conditioned consciousness. That gives rise to our skandhas. That gives rise to our sense perception, our perceptual entrances. That gives rise to contact. That gives rise to feeling, which is a response to the contact. That gives rise to craving, liking or disliking, you know, wanting or getting to get away from. And then that takes us to grasping, or sometimes they call it adoption, which is where, yes, I'm going to do this thing. Then we do it, and then that carries within it the next moment. So yeah, I think it's both of those things. But of course we need to check it out to be sure, but that's kind of how it feels to me. That it's both describing what happens before we're born and then really what's happening every moment. Because every moment that we have a conditioned consciousness and karmic accumulation, we're going to experience stuff based on that. And that's going to... Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Yeah, we do. I think he says something similar to that in here, where he says, you know, when you create these tendencies, you create the tendencies to do them again, which is why it's so important to have Dharma and have the habit of Dharma, because when we have the habit of Dharma, we're creating a new momentum of a new kind of habit. So I have a few friends who a few Dharma friends who like struggle to practice. I was messaging back and forth with one college student. And you know, college students, my gosh, we were all college students at one point, or high school students, or some kind of student. And your life is so busy that you just can't make time to meditate. And he's trying to figure out his career and this, that, the other thing. And he's like, I just can't get to the cushion. And I'm like, keep trying, man. Don't give up. And then he wrote back. He says, okay, I've been on the cushion every day for 3 days. I feel better now. And then he wrote back and he said, now I've been off the cushion for a few days. And I said, don't sweat it. Just get back on. Because really, that's what it comes down to, is just continuing to make that habit. For me, it's songs in my head. Oh, songs in my head. Sometimes, you know, one of the lamas once said, the reason you have songs in your head is that part of you likes it. Part of you, like, likes that song or needs that song, you know? But that's a problem for me, because it's like I could be doing so much better, so many better things with my thoughts than that. And so what I try to do is, you know how in the old car radios, you know, you'd switch the dials around and you'd get a different station. Now you do it push button, you know. I'll do that. I'll just mentally flip a switch and put Om Mani Padme Hum on. That's groovy. I have done that. I have done Om Mani Padme Hum to a tune I like, yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. That's a good one. Okay. We have about maybe 7 minutes, so let's go ahead but thank you for that. I've wondered about that myself. So we'll go through the next few links. Number 8, grasping. A better translation for the 8th link might be, I skipped 7, didn't I? 7 was feeling. Oh, yeah, 8 is grasping or craving, yeah. Oh, I see. He gives them different names. Instead of craving, he calls that one grasping, and instead of grasping, he calls that one adoption. Okay, well, craving. We'll just call it craving because that's what that's on the paper. A better translation for the 8th link would be involvement. Involvement. Since it concerns an involvement instead of a craving with the objective world that one experiences, this craving can be part of a certain situation, such as being in love and craving one's loved one, or a feeling that one has to have people's admiration and respect, or desperately holding on to a material possession. When there is a pleasant feeling, one wishes to keep that feeling. One's mind becomes involved in clinging to this subjective experiences. Besides clinging and grasping at nice experiences, we also reject unpleasant feelings and we want to keep away from them. Involvement can be either a clinging or rejecting. In both, there is some kind of involvement with the objective world one experiences because of the way it makes us feel. Actually, there are 3 kinds of involvement: clinging, rejecting, and indifference. Oh, of course, that would match the 3 mental poisons. Due to a pleasant feeling, one's involvement with that feeling grows to a point where one decides that one definitively needs to acquire the thing which gives rise to the pleasant feeling. On the other hand, one may decide that one needs to get away from the things that give rise to unpleasant feelings. So that brings us to the 9th link, which instead of grasping, he calls adoption. The link of becoming involved with something, either wanting it or avoiding it, leads to the 9th link of adoption, in which one makes definite plans to get the object of one's desire. This could also be a decision to eliminate or avoid something that one has deemed unpleasant. At this stage, the process is still only mental. In the 10th link, the decision is put into action. Now, number 10, becoming. The 10th link is called becoming because at this stage, all of the things that one has thought about, one acts upon. So one has taken action. At this stage, we are doing actual physical, verbal, or mental actions. Since it is necessary for one to perform an actual physical action for the karma to ripen at a later time, This stage is called becoming. The eighth link of grasping or grasping or craving in this description is involved with wanting or avoiding something. And that leads to the ninth link of grasping or adoption, in which one makes definite plans to get the object of desire or eliminate or avoid the thing that we have deemed unpleasant. The tenth link, this decision is put into action. Virtuous actions bring about positive results. Unvirtuous actions bring about negative results. Because the fruition of our actions is determined by the action itself, it is called becoming and involves physical, verbal, and mental karma. These actions do not become nothing after they are finished. Now, this is very important. Our physical, mental, and verbal actions don't become nothing. That's really important because we might think, oh, well, that was just such a little thing. How could that possibly bear fruit? But the answer is it does, because it still makes an imprint on our consciousness. So the way we act with our body, speech, and mind sows seeds which can then bring fruition in the future. The tenth stage of becoming is one of action. It is one of creation of karma. Because of what we come, because of that, we come to the 11th link in this sequence, which is rebirth. Because the actions taken in the 10th link will cause effects in one's next lifetime, the 11th link is called rebirth. The karma that has been created will cause rebirth in samsara. Because of this karma, we will begin a certain type of life, which starts in the womb with the link called name and form. One will be born, body will develop, and one's life will manifest with all its experiences according to the karma accumulated. Because of birth, there will be all the various forms of suffering that one has during life, which is dealt with in the 12th link of aging and death. Although aging and death are two main forms of suffering for all of us, the name of the 12th link, aging and death, stands in for all of the various kinds of suffering, difficulties, and pain which take place in life. All the things which are unpleasant, burdensome, and so forth. All are there because one has been born. And once one has been born, they are inevitable. They are part of the process of life. Once one is born, one begins to age. Once one is born, one must die. All of which are the inevitable consequences of birth. The last link of aging and death contains all of the suffering of existence, which we call samsara. Okay. So that completes the description of this outer link. And there are lots of, again, in this book on the 12 links, he goes into a lot of depth about this, each piece. But for now, we're just covering it in a kind of a light, simplified way. Looking at them as being parts of three different lifetimes. Two and a half? Anyway. Past life, becoming life, future life. And so the reason that we discussed this drawing this weekend is to talk about how we find freedom. How we find freedom in samsara. We find freedom in samsara through making contact with the awakened ones, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, who teach this Dharma. And even just by seeing this drawing, we've made a connection with the Dharma. And even if we don't entirely understand everything that we have seen in this drawing, even if we don't understand it all, we've made contact with these teachings and with the Buddha. Because how we find freedom in samsara is by meeting Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and teachers and Sangha and the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, by making those strong connections with these great beings who teach us these things and by showing us how our mind creates samsara by what we cling to and what we grasp. We can see the wisdom in practicing the Dharma and practicing letting go. And by doing the practice of meditation, we learn how to let go of that which is not worthwhile and how to embrace that which is genuine. And by doing this, letting go of negativity and grasping toward those things which will liberate us, taking hold of those things that will liberate us, we gradually change our behavior to be less self-centered and to be more aimed toward benefiting others. And in being more aimed toward benefiting others, we liberate ourselves gradually from negative habits, and we gradually liberate ourselves from even the sort of hard and fast ideas about our self-concept. And that by doing shamatha and tonglen, shamatha we learn about our minds, tonglen we learn to practice compassion, and in the mantra practice we learn to connect to our Buddha nature. And first in the symbolic way of visualizing ourselves as a Buddha or Bodhisattva, and at the very conclusion by letting go and resting mind in itself, which opens to us the possibility of seeing mind's nature and breaking through the chain of the 12 lengths of ignorance and so on, once and for all. So I appreciate having had the opportunity to spend this weekend with you talking about Dharma and going over this this amazing teaching about how to find freedom through shamatha and compassion and mantra practice. And so it's my hope that this will give you a philosophical underpinning for getting on the cushion this week. We're going to get on the cushion this week. And we're going to notice when we begin to veer off the path, and we'll be able to change the channel in our head when we start repeating songs. And so all of these things hopefully will be of help to us as we're trying to become more dharmic people. So, yes. Oh yeah, the being who's depicted in this is called Yama, Y-A-M-A, Yama, and sometimes he's called the Lord of Death, because you know, the idea is that he is like a samsara personified as a being, you know, sort of like, because death is like the main scourge of samsara. And but it's interesting, in this publication, they also say that that he could be seen in this, you know, he could be seen as an emanation of the wisdom mind of the Buddha, who is teaching us the Dharma by showing us this is samsara. So that's very interesting. I had never considered that idea before. So, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Amitabh, for this wonderful teaching this weekend. We're so grateful for having a whole weekend to spend on Dharma.
Whee!
And the clarity of your teachings is wonderful, and the humor and taking time to answer all of our questions.
Yeah.
So really so grateful, and now feeling very inspired to practice.
Let's all practice!
So that's great. And with that, on behalf of Columbus KCC and the Sangha, we'd like to present you with a small offering.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.